are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It's Thursday, November 29th, 2018. I'm Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, Mike Mariani, he's a contributing writer at GQ. We're talking about the FBI. Are almost all terrorism cases you read about in the news elaborate entrapment cases? And what is the incentive structure, the numbers game inside the FBI that preys on mentally unhealthy, socially vulnerable individuals and hooks them into contrived terror plots?
All in a day's work.
The FBI, talking about that with Mike Mariani. Michael Cohen, pleading guilty to lying to Congress about a potential business deal between Russian investors and the Trump org. Donald Trump, of course, has some incredible sound in response to that. We'll get to that. We are. Deutsche Bank offices are searched as part of a far-reaching money laundering probe. That headline, of course, totally having nothing to do with headlines about Trump and Cohen and Manafort.
It should be a weekly headline.
That should be a daily headline indeed. Paul Manafort's plea deal getting yanked as he has been, apparently, his lawyers in communication with Trump's lawyers, and the screws turn even as Trump dangles the possibility of a pardon. Late night calls between Ultra Sleaze Roger Stone and Ultra Sleaze Donald Trump is drawing the attention of actually slightly sleazy Robert Mueller, because he's one of the reasons that we have these FBI entrapment problems. But it's catching his attention.
He's entrapping the right people this time.
He's entrapping the right people this time, and it's not exactly entrapment, I don't think. Trump, of course, hinting at a possibility of a pardon. Jerome Corsi and Roger Stone knowingly pushed Seth Rich lies to Seth Rich's families. The family of the murdered Seth Rich received propaganda from Corsi and Stone, which they knew to not be true. Apparently,
this is red flaggy all over the place.
U.S. life expectancy declines again in a dismal trend not seen since World War One. Stormfront really digs Tucker Carlson. Fernando Haddad, the Workers' Party candidate in the Brazil's fall elections, is visiting New York in the United States in an effort to bridge solidarity for Brazil, as Bolsonaro salutes Bolton and the United States military industrial complex and corporate sector eagerly sets its sights on a new far-right anti-people alliance across Latin America, a rare victory for democracy and foreign policy and against barbarism, as Bernie Sanders' Yemen bill passes the Senate yesterday, sure to face a Trump veto, but significant progress nonetheless. All that and much, much more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, everybody. The four of us here. Samantha, I guess he was going wild for his birthday yesterday.
Oh, that's right.
Happy birthday, Samantha. That Sam's version of celebrating a birthday is reminiscing on how fun the Mike Cernovich thing was and how great that was for him and us, and then texting us in a text thread to make sure that, I think particularly Matt, because you were probably the most excited about it, knew that the Big Cow story was not real. Important Cedar information.
I almost responded that I don't think I should be alone tonight. It's a fake news.
It is fake news.
I saw it on video.
It almost hurt you the way.
Do you know how it was fake?
Could you imagine what Laurel?
I kind of suspected this, but the cows surrounding it were especially like minuscule.
Did Did you really suspect it was fake? Because I recall you being pretty gung-ho about it, man.
I was more gung-ho about the prospective TMBS YouTube title, which was Giant Cow Baffles Marxist Economist, because we had Richard Wolff in studio.
That is a really good title.
And I really wanted that, but alas.
Fair enough. So Michael Cohen has copped a plea. Specifically, this is actually separate from the whole Stormy Daniels thing, which has been our main exposure to Michael Cohen and Trump's legal troubles in the last couple of months. But this is specifically around lying to Congress around the timing of a Trump possible joint venture for a hotel in Russia. The lie was that the talks of this deal had concluded. The project never went forward. And Cohen was lying to Congress, saying that these talks stopped before the Iowa caucuses. Turns out they continued after the Iowa caucuses. So, you know, this is just kind of, regardless of any bigger kind of Russia stuff here, this is just a sort of like, this. We're in on monuments. Why can't I say that? We're in the just, you know, using the campaign, using the office.
Emoluments?
Emoluments. We're in that territory here. I don't know why I can't say that today. It's bizarre. But Donald Trump, he's on his way to Argentina for the G20 summit. It's sure to be there's going to be a lot of action there. There's actually a citizens effort, an attorney's effort to apprehend MBS there. And Buenos Aires as well. So hopefully the left will be out in strong force protesting in Argentina. Donald Trump's on his way there. And he, of course, had a very succinct, very clear answer to the Michael Cohen question that got shouted to him this morning on the White House lawn. This is really when Trump is sort of lying and all over the place like this, but still in a very obvious way, hedging his language.
Mm-hmm.
This is when you know that he's quite aware and quite tense about his potential jeopardy he's in.
Yeah, he likes to like explore different ways of framing and putting things into language.
Exactly. And it's super subtle. Nobody can tell.
Michael Cohen has made many statements to the House, as I understand it, and the Senate. He put out a statement talking about a project which was essentially, I guess, more or less of an option that we were looking at in Moscow. Everybody knew about it. It was written about in newspapers. It was a well-known project. It was during the early part of 16, and I guess even before that. It lasted a short period of time. I didn't do the project. I decided not to do the project, so I didn't do it. So we're not talking about doing a project. We're talking about not doing a project. Michael Cohen, what he's doing is he was convicted, I guess. You'll have to put it into legal terms. But he was convicted with a fairly long-term sentence on things totally unrelated to the Trump Organization, having to do with mortgages and having to do with cheating the IRS, perhaps. A lot of different things. I don't know exactly. But he was convicted of various things unrelated to us. He was given a fairly long jail sentence. And he's a weak person, and by being weak, unlike other people that you watch, he's a weak person, and what he's trying to do is get a reduced sentence. So he's lying about a project that everybody knew about. I mean, we were very open with it. We were thinking about building a building. I guess we had in a form. It was an option. I don't know what you'd call it. I decided ultimately not to do it. There would have been nothing wrong if I did do it. If I did do it, there would have been nothing wrong. That was my business.
That's beautiful. So, well, I'm sure there are a variety of legal troubles that Michael Cohen's involved in. Definitely his plea bargains have definitely all had to do with the Trump Organization, because that was his prime employer and who he was primarily lying on behalf of. The person he's talking about who might have more character than Michael Cohen is clearly Paul Manafort, who is a calculating career criminal who's still hoping for a pardon that Donald Trump is dangling in front of him.
That's what he said. That's obviously what our position is.
Exactly, Paul. And so, and just to add to the, you know, comedy of lies here, we now have, you know, you have one son who is clearly the product of neglect and whatever ultra bizarre emotional and psychic issues are going on in that house. And he's the one who Trump will, I don't know, maybe follow back on Twitter or something. Of course, I'm talking about Don Jr. Then you have the other son who there's just a lot of basic misfortune with this guy. And he's the true embarrassment. And this clip is not helping.
Every time there's an international incident, they say, well, the president's too nice to Vladimir Putin. That's because he has so many investments in Russia. He says he's too open to letting this investigation play out. That's because he has investments in Saudi Arabia. You're running the Trump Organization. What's the reality?
There's zero investments in Russia. There's zero investments in Saudi. We have absolutely nothing to do with those countries. And by the way, my father's been tougher on Russia than probably any human being in the world. That's what happens when you give offensive weapons to Ukraine, right? Obama never did that. That's what happens when you promote, you know, American energy. You take away their largest financial, you know, stream, which is oil. I mean, that's what built oil and gas is what built Russia. And all of a sudden we're saying, hey, you know what? Why don't you buy American oil? We've got a lot of great oil workers. We've got a lot of great energy in the U.S. How about this? We'll supply you all the energy you could ever possibly need. Don't buy it from Russia.
Can you talk to your dad about?
Okay. So obviously we'll start. He's lying. There's relationships with Russia. We know this. Then Saudi, well, maybe look to Jared Kushner on that relationship. Then there's, okay, yes, this actually is important to bear in mind for the resistance types. And I'm not somebody, I think that people needed a much smarter, more nuanced perspective about what happened in Ukraine several years ago. There was obviously a fascistic far right that opposed a Russian presence there, but there was also a left-oriented democracy movement, and it's complicated. And I'm not interested in excusing Russian Monroe policy any more than I'm interested in excusing U.S. Monroe policy in terms of controlling its neighbors. That being said, it was great that Barack Obama didn't fuel that conflict by giving offensive weapons to Ukraine. And there's a lot of neoliberal hawk idiots. And that was a subtle but hugely important difference between Obama and Hillary Clinton, because she did want to ramp up the weapons capacity of what's sent to Ukraine. So if this becomes another thing where you're pushing Trump to cover up these bizarre connections, which really are going to amount to questions of oligarchy and corruption with the Russian regime, to fuel an ultra-hawkish NATO expansionist policy, along with what he's already doing with arms control, that would be, well, just be polite, very short-sighted. And the third point is I don't think any oil-producing country that is blocking the transition to a post-fossil fuel world is going to be extremely happy with the Trump administration's approach to energy, including Russia.
Yeah, you know, anybody going through an FBI investigation, there's sort of an unfairness, like, as we'll sort of discover in the interview coming up, I think.
Right.
That it's sort of like running hurdles in a pitch dark gymnasium. But with the Mueller investigation, the reason like I'm not so concerned about the unfairness is that it's like making the worst people in the world run through that hurdle.
Yeah, they're the worst people on earth.
So like,
and there's going to be things there. I mean, that's the thing that's so funny
right.
about it. It's like if there's nothing to the Russia thing, and I think it's proven at this point, there's definitely something to it. But even if there was nothing to it, if you put a team of forensic investigators on the Trump Organization's finances,
exactly.
I mean, are you kidding me?
It's going to be hard for them to not run into
right.
something. Like,
if you didn't find multiple global crimes, I would be shocked, like genuinely.
I still think that they're going to get out of it somehow.
Who, everybody?
I mean, not everybody.
Okay, not everybody, like Trump and his top guys.
I mean,
I don't think Manafort's going to get away.
Manafort's not. Manafort's there. But anyway, I mean, whatever. Even regardless, so bleed him out for 2020. There, whatever way you spin it, it's not good politically for him to have to be on the lawn talking this nonsense. That's not a good look. Elites usually get away with things. 2018 has been a difficult year for human rights, but have you ever wondered how rights abuses are documented around the world? You probably have, with the sheer volume of global crises we're seeing, from civilian casualties in Syria to ethnic cleansing in Myanmar to the caging of children on U.S. borders. It's critical that we expose truth in order to defend rights of all and bring those responsible to justice. Human Rights Watch does just that. They're an independent, nonprofit organization known for their accurate fact-finding, impartial reporting, and targeted advocacy, often in partnership with local activists and human rights groups. They accept no money from any government, but rely on the support of informed, dedicated people just like you. So if human rights are important to you, visit hrw.org/majority to make a donation and support its vital work around the world. When you do it, not only is your gift tax deductible, it will be matched dollar for dollar until 2019. That means your donation will go twice as far to advance justice and defend the basic dignity of the people who need it most. Again, that's hrw.org/majority. We'll be right back with Mike Mariani on the Majority Report. Welcome back to the Majority Report. Michael Brooks here. Joining us now is Mike Mariani. He's a contributing writer for GQ. His piece, The Would-Be Terrorist Versus the FBI, was released on the November 20th issue of GQ. Mike, tell us about this 26-year-old, or in 2010, he was 26 years old, Matthew, and I'm going to butcher this, Matthew Lenza?
Matthew Lenza.
Who was he? Where did he grow up? And how did he come to the attention of the FBI?
Yeah, absolutely. So Matthew Lenza, he grew up in Mesa, Arizona. Mm-hmm. It's near Phoenix, somewhat close to the border with Mexico. He grew up living with his grandparents and his mom. His mom had him when she was pretty young. So her parents did, helped out quite a bit raising him. Eventually, he moved up to the Bay Area. His dad actually had moved up to the Oakland, San Francisco Bay Area when he was really young. So he went up there presumably to look for work. He really couldn't find very much work in Mesa. From his perspective, it was kind of plagued by drug cartels and drug dealing and just a lot of just crime and perilousness. Mm-hmm. So he moved up to the Bay Area in his Winnebago. This is around 2010. And sometime in late 2010, the court documents are a little bit vague on exactly what happened. But sometime in late 2010, Matthew made one or multiple social media posts ranting against American foreign policy and expressing sympathy for jihadist groups or overseas terrorist organizations. And it was that that act, that social media post, that first alerted the FBI to Matthew Lenza's existence.
And then one other thing, just in terms of setting up his background, and this is a really well-written piece, and there's a lot of detail and nuance to it. He goes and he spends time with his father, and his father's concerned about his son's mental health, and he's concerned about the security of his new family. But could you explain that a little bit? There's a concern about him, but it's not – He wasn't threatening people in his immediate vicinity, and he had a gun collection, but he never harmed anybody. Is that right? And what happened as a result of his guns being discovered in 2011?
Exactly right. So he only had one gun. It was a gun that he actually had registered in Arizona when he moved across state lines. It became illegal in California. he didn't really, he either wasn't aware of that or didn't make the proper accommodations to adhere to the new state laws. So he did have a mental health episode or a mental breakdown, if you like, in April, I believe, of 2011. This was after he'd been living in his Winnebago on the curb in front of his father's house for some time. He said some things that were disturbing to his father. We don't know exactly what they were. Some court documents implied that they might have had to do with him taking his own life. So it could have been kind of suicidal language. Mm-hmm. Again, we really don't know, though. That's not – it's hard to say. So some aspects of that incident are vague. But it was enough that his father – reached out and had medical personnel come to his house. They decided that he was unstable enough that it warranted what's called a mental health hold. And that's a 72-hour psychiatric hospitalization, an involuntary one. And over the course of those 3 days, police officers returned to the Matthews Winnebago and his father's residence and expressed concern to Matthew's father, who then went into his Winnebago and discovered this gun that he had brought in from Arizona. And that's what triggered that first stint in jail in California for about a year.
He got a year bid just for that unregistered gun. And in the context of what was already like was a basically a concern about his mental health.
Yeah. So actually, yeah, and the biggest upshot of that episode was that during those 72 hours, he was diagnosed with bipolar disorder and paranoid psychosis.
Right.
Which, you know, is a very severe diagnosis, and it in some ways came out of nowhere because he really had no history of being diagnosed. He did have an elaborate history of unusual behavior and thought patterns, but he had never really gotten adequate mental health treatment for it. So it was only this incident that spurred him to receive this very serious diagnosis.
So I'm going to just do a little editorial here. This is already the first part in the piece where just this total barbarism of the justice system, this case in the policing and gun charge level, because you have somebody who you finally discovered that they have very serious issues that they're dealing with that could explain some of the anguish and the context of what's going on with them. They have a, you know, an unregistered gun, clearly could have been, I mean, just, you know, a mistake moving across state lines. And instead of an effort to help this guy, they're going to stick him in prison for a year, and that's going to be the upshot of his diagnosis. So already we're in just this incredibly cruel, barbarous territory. Now, let's run a parallel track for a second. So this is what's happening with this this troubled young man that really could use our help. We're also in a post-September 11th world, and the FBI is shifting and pivoting its resources and its focus to terrorism. Obviously, there's a real reason behind this. Can't, you know, of course, September 11th is a real thing. There are actual terrorist groups, but the whole infrastructure of the bureaucracy is sort of reorienting towards terrorism. Robert Mueller, who was then the FBI director, increased the number of joint terrorist task forces throughout the country, which were first introduced in the 1980s. I'm going to quote from you really briefly.
Sure.
JTTFs work to ferret out terrorist plots through monitoring, surveillance, investigation, and not least, the cultivation of sources on the ground. These sources, known as informants, work to get close to individuals as a group or task force believes may be capable of committing a terrorist crime. Talk about the rise of these task forces and the differences that started to take place after September 11th in terms of who they could actually target and use their informants to go after in terms of the loosening of standards.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, in addition to reporting on Matthew's story, I obviously did want to parallel that with how things had changed since 9/11 in terms of the FBI, its counterterrorism division, and its sting operations. One of the people I reached out to is a man named Michael German, mm-hmm. who was an FBI agent for, I think, maybe 12 or 13 years, and now is a really strong whistleblower, basically, for its behavior, its tactics, like you said, its standards since 9/11. What he told me is that when he was there, which was primarily in the 90s, in order to initiate a sting operation, which was what was initiated on Matthew, FBI agents needed to either prove that a group or an individual was actively planning to commit a crime or was explicitly connected to some sort of criminal or terrorist organization. One of those two things, or both, had to be in place for a sting to be launched. Now, if you look at some of the cases since 9/11, there's about 870 of them, of individuals being prosecuted for terrorism offenses. And you just start to look at brief descriptions of a lot of them, or dig deeper, you'll find that in many cases, neither of those things are in place. These people, Matthew included, have zero actual concrete connection to a terrorist organization and were not explicitly planning a criminal act.
So there's a big media piece to this because there's also a major failure in how the media has reported on these stories. And there's also definitely a numbers game and a bureaucratic incentive structure inside the FBI, which reflects broader problems. I'm thinking there's a book came out, I think it was called Numbers of Mass Destruction. I forget the author's name, but she talks about the problem with these quantitative targets across the board in business and in law enforcement, mm-hmm. Creating these incredibly unjust and crude social outcomes. And the same thing's going on with the FBI. But let's go back to Matthew. So Matthew leaves jail after a year. Now he has a criminal record. So in addition to serious issues he's dealing with, both in terms of his mental and emotional health and his ability to have stability, not trained, not educated, and now the stigma of crime, right? So all and the trauma of being in prison for a year. I mean, God knows what only happened there. And all of a sudden he lucks out or appears to luck out. And this is in some ways another gut punch if you're reading this with any empathy. He gets offered a job. He basically working for a small plumbing outfit. Explain that and what emerges out of this plumbing job. What's really going on there?
Yeah, so he gets out of prison. He has the felony on his record or the crime on his record. There's the stigma. But more importantly for him, there are all the fees and costs associated with going through the court system, going through the criminal justice system. So he had to pay a monthly probationary fee. He owed his lawyer a certain amount of money. And there may be one or two other expenses that I'm not remembering. But it amounted to several thousand dollars, which for him was a lot, that he had to find a way to pay for. And this is as soon as he's released from prison. Eventually, he did have to sell his Winnebago, which, I'm assuming was his most valuable possession, his most valuable property to his name. And at a certain point, after he was released, he did find a job at a plumbing company in the Bay Area. It seemed like something of a godsend at the time because he really couldn't get any work, not even, day by day manual labor type of stuff. So he was desperate, desperate for employment, desperate for a steady paycheck. This comes out of nowhere. Furthermore, one of the people at the plumbing company, it seems like it was a supervisory relationship, was also really benevolent towards Matthew, helped pick him up and drop him off, helped him get food when he needed food, was just really solicitous and really helpful in terms of Matthew just getting his life together and kind of just surviving on a week-to-week basis. Now, what's really going on, what Matthew obviously had no idea about at the time, is that this person at the plumbing company is an FBI informant. And he has been dispatched by the FBI to feel out Matthew's feelings about America, about overseas jihadist groups, and more importantly, his willingness to act on those sentiments and on those ideologies. And they have conversations. Again, court documents are somewhat vague on the real concretes and specifics of those conversations, but it seems clear that they talk about Matthew's interest in aligning himself or joining overseas terrorist organizations.
And this starts to evolve, and Matthew's, you know, claiming Islam at this point. Then there's a cousin, I think, that comes in who's supposedly connected with the Taliban. And they start to spell out this elaborate. And in this case, right, so I would say for me, you know, just stipulating, and obviously some of these cases here where the FBI kind of takes a troubled person and sets up a scenario for them, that's a problem structurally. But, mm-hmm. you know, in some of these cases, obviously these people, even though it was all imaginary, they're agreeing to do acts that are heinous. They would kill a lot of innocent people. Matthew actually doesn't want to have – he wants to basically blow up a building when no one's in it, if I read you correctly. Mm-hmm. And then there's this, like, whole fantastical scenario about how, like, that will lead to, like, an American Civil War. My point being is, like, it's not even really like a traditional, like, this is something that the Pakistani Taliban would want, or ISIS, or something like that. It's very much, it's almost like a something out of like an Alex Jones conspiracy or something. And they're feeding this plot to him the whole time. And then they also tell him, they basically also paint, and I want you to fill it in a second, like, this amazing fantasy life if he does this. So thinking of somebody who's totally marginalized, has very tenuous connections, suffers these mental health problems, and they tell him not only, like, you know, forget getting rewarded in heaven, right? Like, if right. you do this, we're going to take you to somewhere in South Asia, I think Pakistan, and we're going to set you up nice.
Yeah.
What did they tell
him? That's exactly right. I mean, the first thing, the point that you make, which I think really can't be highlighted enough, is Matthew's scheme that he comes up with is not connected really in any way with traditional, what we think of as a terrorist attack or something that is motivated by religious extremism in any way. What he wants to do, just briefly, is he wanted to make this bank bombing, which again, he insisted, you know, he was serious about, did not inflict any casualties, look like something that was planned and executed by a right-wing militia organization, which then would trigger a harsh and vicious federal governmental response, which would then in turn spark either another response from a smattering of right-wing groups and organizations or all-out civil war. And so when I discovered that plot, that scheme, that idea, the fact that he had come up with this idea and his relationship to cause and effect and the fact that he actually thought that this was in some ways plausible and that all this causal chain would really be triggered by this bombing, to me, it was just such a powerful demonstration of this is where this individual is mentally. This right. is what his relationship to reality is. And yet it didn't really seem to cause people to bat an eye in terms of continuing with the sting operation.
You say that even at one point, the informant or somebody involved in setting up this whole scam on Matthew with the FBI actually said, like, this guy isn't a threat.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So in the defense sentencing memorandum, there are a handful of exhibits, which I was able to get my hands on. And some of them are conversations with the informant at the plumbing company. And at one point, you know, he describes Matthew as harmless. He also talks about how, I don't know if you want to get into this at another point, but Matthew was on a lot of medication in 2012. Mm-hmm. So he talks about how Matthew could, quote, barely hold a shovel at work. Because of, presumably, it doesn't say this explicitly, but it seems quite clear or more than likely that it had to do with all the medication he was on, or the medication that was being introduced to him over and over as they tried to find something that was the right fit for his disorders. And so in addition to being mentally ill, I mean, he was on meds that he was having a lot of trouble negotiating, you know, and that were making each day probably seemingly disorienting to the point where he couldn't even hold his tools at work.
So, and nothing gives pause. They go forward and they eventually set up a fake bomb. They do the whole thing. He's arrested. And then I think there, you know, there's a couple other things that sort of spill out of this. I mean, one is, well, first let's focus on the FBI. What's going on here in terms of the careerism and the incentive structure, and how broad a problem is this? Because it has been my understanding, you know, in addition to your reporting, that a lot of terrorism cases that we see reported actually have been boiling down to this scenario, like a very significant amount of them, which is an informant and there's what did you say? I think there's like 15,000 of these people, which is a pretty that's a large number for, you know, think about across 50 states,
sure.
And a relatively isolated amount of communities, you know, basically inducing often just really troubled, marginalized young men into fake plots, and then essentially charging them with their participation in a fantasy life. So why, like, what's going on at the FBI that there's a culture of this?
Yeah, so this was definitely not one of the first things that I intended to explore in any significant detail when I set out to report this story. But after speaking to enough experts, it became clear, yeah, that this element of quote, careerism at play in the FBI's counterterrorism division. So just to kind of sketch it out, as we all might assume, since 9/11, the counterterrorism division of the FBI has grown and grown and grown. You know, there are a lot of joint terrorism task forces throughout the country, maybe something like 70 or 80. And the reality is every year, the counterterrorism division has to go to Congress about its budget. Right. And they have to prove that they need a certain amount of money to continue to employ these JTTFs and to power this division. So in order to do that, and as Michael German put it, they need to, quote, prove statistical accomplishments. So the bottom line is that if they want to keep the budget that they've grown over the course of the past decade and a half or so, it's incumbent upon them to make arrests, you know, and to move individuals through the criminal justice system, you know, and to get get them to prosecutors and to get convictions. So in a way, there is an incentivization, there's an incentive structure for them to nab individuals committing terrorist crimes, you know, or however they can, which is, you know, where stings come into play and all the moral issues and ethical quandaries that come with these stings.
And what about the failure of how the media reports on these in terms of being clear that, you know, because there was a period of time where there would be like a headline. Like, whoa, there's this operational cell. It sounds like 24, and they're in Miami, and they're going to blow up this building, and they have this, this, and this, and this. And then you'd read the article, and you'd be like, oh, it was like a group of guys who were really high, and they requested like special like Muslim ninja outfits, and the FBI just basically, you know, just hustled some like, you know, messed up dudes into a fake thing, and now their lives are destroyed.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean that was a point that I felt was pretty important. In that, you know, when these arrests take place, the FBI will issue a statement. They may have a press conference, and at least for a while, it's evolved a little bit in recent years. But for a long time, this century, the media just jumped and lunged at the headline. You know, from these statements, from these press conferences, and from these arrests. And there was probably a certain level of embellishment or exaggeration, maybe not on the part, maybe it might have been on the part of the FBI, it might have been on the part of individual media organizations, but what it amounted to were these headlines that were misleading. You know, there's no question about it. And the real problem occurs because it takes some time, even today, even to this day, for journalists and other people to really parse what's going on in these individual cases and make sense of, okay, you know what? This subway station was not actually about to be blown up, you know, right. Or this building, right. To kind of parse the nuances of what really was at stake. But the problem is that by the time people can make sense of what the stakes really were, the news cycle has moved on. So to me, that has been a real problem since 9/11, the fact that the media may only be infatuated by these arrests for 24, 48, or 72 hours, and that's not enough time for them to, in many cases, to really make sense of, okay, what did these individuals or this individual really do, and what were the nuances between them and the sting operation that kind of facilitated this crime.
So, okay, so media is sensationalistic and bad, and they need to do a way better job, and people need to have media literacy. So this is like lesson 500 million of that. What about, you know, the legal question? And I understand this is a lot more complicated how it actually plays out in a courtroom, and obviously courtrooms are very favorable towards prosecutors. But it kind of reminds me of the scene in The Wire where Bodhi, I don't know if you've seen that show, but Bodhi is one of my favorite characters. Yeah. Is in a police, you know, he's in an interrogation room, and they're laying a case out to him that's dependent on this open air drug market, and he's like, "Isn't that entrapment?" And McNulty, who's the cool cop, is like, "I think the kid has a point." And they have to let him go. So my question is, to paraphrase Bodhi, how are all of these cases not essentially giant entrapment cases?
Yeah, it's a really tough question. And it's a question that I posed to a lot of people while reporting this story. I guess the best way to distill it is to explain my understanding of what a defense attorney needs to do to win an entrapment case, to actually, you know, to stage an entrapment defense and win it. So what they have to do is they need to first prove inducement. So they have to prove that the FBI explicitly induced this individual or individuals to commit this terrorist crime. And that already is really fraught with gray areas because it's so hard to tell how the conversations begin, how the planning begins. Usually it's between, you know, two or more people. So being able to really isolate inducement is extremely difficult. And then the second thing that they have to do, the second bar they have to clear, is they have to prove that their client had no predisposition to commit this crime, which is also extremely difficult. Now, this didn't really come up too much with Matthew, but with speaking to the experts, I've heard that in some cases, proving predisposition is easy because it can be so vague.
Right.
So even if a defendant, you know, went on YouTube and watched a jihadist video or a video that looks askew at American foreign policy, even things like that, that are only really dealing with their ideological growth, you know, as teenagers, as 20-somethings, as young people. That, in some cases, seems to be enough to say, look, here's predisposition.
Right.
Even though that may have no connection to the specifics and the concretes of the actual crime. So, you know, to jump through both those hoops is really difficult to prove inducement and to prove that their client has no predisposition to commit the crime. And that's why it has never worked in a terrorist case.
It has never worked. And even in the most ludicrous cases, it's never worked because we're in thought crime territory. I mean, because you really are just saying essentially like, well, hey, let's make it really high quality here. This guy watched, he watched a Noam Chomsky video on U.S. supported coups. That seems hostile.
Right.
Right. That's the logic of it.
Exactly.
Yep.
And those are just, I mean, that's like an intellectual, it's the world of ideas.
Right.
And they're seemingly using that in some cases from my reporting to prove just predisposition.
Right. Okay. I mean, so it's really clear what the situation is, and it's very clear what the incentive structure is. This piece is excellent. There's also a piece, I think it's called The Terrorism Factory. It's a book, if that's The Terror Factory by Trevor Aronson, which came out in 2013, but you referenced, and that's still a really important book, holds up well for explaining this phenomenon.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where is Matthew now? Have you been in touch with him? And what, you know, as this system from the local police to the FBI have just been totally grinding and, you know, destroying this human life. Where is he? What happened to him? Have you spoken to him?
Yeah. Yeah. So he's at federal prison in Oregon, Oregon's one federal prison. Over the summer when I was spring and summer, when I was reporting this story, I reached out to just about anybody I could get contact information for in his family and then him too. And the one person I actually was able to get through to was Matthew. We spoke through email and then we spoke on the phone, and I had maybe 12 or 15 phone conversations with him over the course of the summer. He's going to be in prison for another 7, 8, 9 years. I don't know the specifics of if there is any eligibility for parole. I'm not sure if there is in federal when dealing with federal crimes. But yeah, I mean, he's there. He's there for a long time. I think that when I spoke to him, it was probably one of the first times that he was really revisiting what happened in 2011, 12, and 13, and trying to kind of analyze it and examine it and make sense of it. I think it happened so fast. His mental illnesses and his medication may have made it some parts of it a blur to him. And he just was trying to dissect it on the phone with me.
Well, and also it's, yeah. And I just, when in the interview with him and people read it, like, it's the way even you can kind of trait some of the things that he's been afflicted with in terms of just going right back to the beginning of the interview, like his misperception of just how dangerous and baroque his environment was of Mesa, Arizona, like really thinking that, like, experiencing the world like it was like a scene in Sicario over and over and over again, lines straight up to this delusional plot, right? So up till his interactions on the phone with you, where he still has a lot of, you know, very serious paranoia about the world. And of course, what's just so depressing and gutting about it is that intuitively his paranoia becomes right, because in fact, one of the most powerful agencies in the United States and his false friends all are actually on a conspiracy to destroy his life for their own, you know, various forms of advancement. And that's kind of the most gut-wrenching irony of the piece for me.
Yeah. I mean, you kind of pinpointed it perfectly. It's like this moment of poetic injustice or something, where he's been delusional his whole life, at least from what I was able to report and to discern. And he has overestimated the level of danger around him for such a long time. And then suddenly it all comes to a head and his paranoid thinking actually perfectly matches the schemes and the plots taking place around him with him as their target. It's an extraordinarily sad symmetry that kind of climaxes when he is arrested. And like I said, you know, just because it makes for an interesting insight in the story doesn't make it any easier for him. You know, obviously he has to deal with these awful, awful consequences. But yeah, it's.
Mike Mariani, the piece is The Would-Be Terrorist versus the FBI. It's in GQ. It's indispensable reading. Please go out, read it, share it widely. It's a very well-written, very human story, which opens the door into this really enormous abuse by the FBI, the terrorism complex, and federal prosecutors in the post-9/11 era, and the human costs of it, as distilled in Matthew. Mike, really appreciate your time, man. Thanks so much.
All right. Thank you so much for having me.
Of course. All right, folks. I love how this show is so skewed in a way that where I want to go after that was really, it was a gut-wrenching piece. I read it last night and I had to like pace around the apartment. It was so upsetting. And now having that same experience in the interview. And you know how we go into our defense mechanisms when we're feeling stress? So I love Judy, totally. So this is, please do not. But I did want to go into like a, don't you love fucking Robert Mueller? I was like, no, I don't love fucking Robert Mueller. God damn it.
Seriously.
I'm glad that the same tricks that have been used to terrorize the mentally vulnerable are now being used on the worst people on earth. That's beautiful. I'm all for that. But no, I do not like... Robert, to paraphrase.
Yeah, what's good is the resources are being.
Yes.
Those resources shouldn't be there in the first place.
Indeed.
But as long as they're there, point them in the right direction.
Point them at Trump Inc., indeed. Trump Org, or whatever the hell it is.
That still doesn't make it worth it that we have these institutions.
No, it really does not. Okay, now, of course, you really. Okay, here is Brian Krasenstein, who is a well-known former multi-level marketing guy and now a leader in the resistance, right?
Yeah, yeah. He has him and his, are they twins? His brother.
I think they're twins.
They have a website called The Hill Reporter, which is very funny.
That is so brilliant.
Because
that's so great.
When you see that in print, it looks as if they work for The Hill and they're reporting for it. They are. The thing is I've called the Krasensteins out for being grifters a number of times. And they Twitter searched their name, so they'd be like, "What did I say that was wrong?" and the truth is that they're actually, despite being I think transparent grifters to me, they're very good at it. They clearly get results.
They might sincerely believe it. They might believe in multi-level marketing. They might believe in the FBI.
Grifting can be unconscious.
That's just one more reason, one more example of why intentions don't matter.
Grifting can be unconscious. I mean, look, intentions, I'm not 100% on board with the like Cedar position of intentions are totally irrelevant. They matter.
Emotionally and interpersonally relevant.
And they matter when we frame some of our opponents. But Brian, the Krasensteins are not inside the tent.
It reminds me of that protest. I saw a picture of a guy holding up a sign at one of the Russia-related protests that just said, "I love laws." Like, you fucking nerd. Come on.
I love laws. Jesus Christ.
That guy is the reductio ad absurdum of the resistance.
And that is also where, on a sort of psychic level, Trump speaks to more elemental human truths. Although they're like, laws aren't fun necessarily.
I would like to show up at a protest in the I love regulations.
Yeah.
I mean, it's possible.
I love the regulatory state.
It's possible that was, an Antifa guy who had to make a new sign real fast as a disguise after smashing a Starbucks
or
something.
Most unconvincing.
That would be fucking funny if everybody, like a black bloc
person. It's a black bloc person going
just, like,
undercover.
Brick a Starbucks and
yeah, for black,
put on a cardigan and it's like, respect FBI.
For the black bloc, for the black bloc going undercover is taking your mask off and having a really lame ass poster.
Yeah.
Well, there
sort
is
of like, wait for the Mueller report.
There is a sort of a movement now to have like a normie block so they can't really tell who you are, which I think is much
smarter. Well, that would be much smarter.
That's very smart thinking. The
IRA had Sinn Féin. Guys,
I mean, look, like, the optics of these things is secondary importance to the underlying, you know, material concerns, et cetera, et cetera. But there's something to be said about, like, look at the picture with the Ferguson girl with her prom dress on, right? Like,
that was big, right? Exactly.
You got to play the media game to a certain extent if you're going
100%.
To
you got
to
do the people who came out the day after Charlottesville, suburban people being like, get the fuck out of here. You racist morons ruining our town. And that's also the counterpoint, because you never can count on NBC to cover it right. So they'll have the Identity Europa guy and be like, well, what do you know? He brushes his teeth and he hates Jews.
He says he's not racist.
Yeah, he says he's not racist. Whoa-ho-ho. But you got to play that game. So therefore, you do need the equivalent of,
there's a reason they play.
I'm
that
a
game.
Normal person who happens to have taken World War II seriously. Like, I trust Captain America, therefore I hate fascists.
I'm going to signify to you right up front that we don't have a lot in common.
Yeah, exactly. And it's just not good strategy. On Tuesday, we had an amazing time with Professor Richard Wolff. And now you can get all... Will you want to just throw that up for a second, Matt? The Michael Brooks Show YouTube page. Just want to say for a second that there's a huge amount of clips there now. So you can really get a feel of the show.
And no ads.
And no ads yet. We haven't monetized it yet because free speech is being hindered
by
YouTube.
We're being suppressed and shadow banned.
We're being suppressed and shadow banned. But yeah, look, we have pieces on Brazil, what needs to be said, the race, Democrats, race, and economic anxiety. We have Richard Wolff. Woke Bros with Waz and I, we're covering why beer is ruining, capitalism is ruining beer. We had a lot. I mean, obviously, as you'd expect, a lot more global stuff, a lot more kind of pop culture, but also IDW, Marxism. It's really fun. Great clips with Richard Wolff and ContraPoints this weekend. Go subscribe to the YouTube channel. And from now on, the live Tuesday Michael Brooks Show will be streaming live on Michael Brooks Show YouTube channel. This Sunday, an illicit history of logic with Ben Burgess for patrons. It's an interesting conversation on can tool logic be rescued from the sophistry of the right, and also kind of interesting historical philosophy lesson. And you do not want to miss any of the post games, particularly, of course, the ones that just happened, Richard Wolff. So patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS, well on our way. And come see us at the Bell House February 1st. Michael Brooks live show. And of course, come to the Majority Report live show January 12th, also at the Bell House, January 13th, also at the Bell House. Both links to those tickets, both Majority Report and Michael Brooks show live shows, are at the majority.fm homepage. Buy them fast because they are going fast. Jamie.
All right. So as you all know, Sean and I were on vacation for 10 days, so we don't have a lot of new stuff for you. But we did unlock our Real Maoist Hours, wherein we read a document, possibly real, possibly fake, about the Florida Communist Front's plan for a protracted people's war in the Florida Everglades. People got mad at us because they're like, oh, it's fake. It's obviously fake. But it was still fun. If it was a fun bit of satire that hit pretty close to home for some of the more adventurous elements of the left, and it was fun. I'd also like to plug a couple of events that the DSA is putting on, including the holiday party this weekend. If you're in the New York area, The New York City DSA is throwing its annual holiday fundraising party. It's called Reds Need Green, a DSA fundraiser. There'll be a performance from Shilpa Ray, really, really awesome musician, kind of bluesy, punky, sexy, amazing. And that's from 8 to 12. I'll put a link in the episode description. Also, this ties in with a lot of things we were just talking about in the interview. The Libertarian Socialist Caucus and the Black Socialists of America have worked together to put on a panel on the history and effects of COINTELPRO tonight.
Nice.
Yeah.
COINTELPRO.
At Star Bar in Bushwick, featuring Jamal Joseph of the Black Panthers, who actually did a number of years in prison, who can talk about its effects on him personally and on the organization, as well as...
Yeah, COINTELPRO, very important thing to understand. Yeah. That's awesome.
As well as Michael Stephen Smith, and yeah.
Awesome. Well, if I wasn't going to a Fernando Haddad event tonight, I would go to that, actually. Matt.
A Literary Hangover is my podcast.
And
check
good.
That
good.
Check that baby out.
Short and sweet. All right, folks, we'll see you in the fun half.
C'est une poupée. Une poupée qui dit oui, elle dit jamais non, de jour comme de nuit. Qu'on la pose ici ou qu'on la tire ailleurs, dans son bain ou dans son lit. Elle dit jamais non, dit jamais